going to ask Ann if she would call roll.
Commissioner Church?
Here.
Commissioner Drake?
Here.
Commissioner Glynn?
Here.
Commissioner Kirkpatrick Pilger?
Here.
Commissioner Ockenden?
Here.
Commissioner Wolf?
Here.
Commissioner Wright?
Here.
Commissioner Goodwin?
Here.
And Commissioner Moore and Edner are absent.
Who's
out
of IRS? Welcome everybody to our workshop. I want to take a moment and explain the purpose of these workshops a little bit more, and I'd prefer to have a prepared statement to read. The purpose of Planning Commission workshops is to familiarize members with issues that will come before them, provide an opportunity for exchanging ideas regarding relevant topics, and solicit agency or expert opinions to add to the body of knowledge before the Commission considers changes to the comprehensive plan, policy, or text of the Land Development Code. Workshops serve as a forum for training new members in procedural or administrative rules and for informing the Commission of changes in state statute or case law that affect land use decisions. They provide an opportunity to determine the Commission's schedule of upcoming hearings, meetings, or future workshops, and a chance to form subcommittees or focus groups on land use issues. Because workshops are intended to serve the entire membership of the Planning Commission, full attendance is anticipated, and when a quorum is present, meetings are subject to Oregon Public Meetings Law. Notice is published on the county's website, on the county meetings bulletin board, and in the Daily Courier. Planning Commission workshops are open for the public to attend, but are not an opportunity for public testimony. So with that, let us go to item two on the agenda, Land Development Advisory Committee, LDAC, recommendations for revisions to the Rural Land Development Code. And I'd ask Dave Wechner to introduce that for us.
Thanks, Sam. The Land Development Advisory Committee has been meeting for over a year. They came up with several recommendations, which went to the board and on June 15th. Committee Chair Harold Hoggins in the audience tonight, and he brought those recommendations to the Board of Commissioners. They contemplated them for a couple of months and finally gave me the direction to bring that to you to contemplate for changes to the Land Development Code. The Planning Commission will be charged with deciding which of those recommendations to move forward with in public hearing. And this meeting tonight is primarily to familiarize you with those recommendations. They are on three major topics: changes to the street standards, deer winter range, and Article 76, wildfire protection standards. And I'm going to have staff introduce each of those topics tonight. You received some materials via email. It was a black and white copy, but the comments were done in color, so they were easier understood. So we provide you some written copies that are hard copies that are in color. Roger Harada is going to go first and discuss Article 76 standards. We're actually doing them in reverse order. James Black is going to discuss deer winter range. And then representatives of Public Works are here to talk about proposed changes to the street standards. And the purpose of the staff introduction is really to introduce you to the issue, talk about the current standards, so what we do currently, and then you can compare it to this. Some of these items the Planning Commission see before, but not in the full context that staff see them, such as Article 76 is applicable to single-family dwellings, but we don't see single-family dwellings, single home sites in the Planning Commission. We see them as a staff. So I want to give you some additional background on how we implement these codes right now, and then we'll field some questions, and that'll help you sort of compare the old apple with the new orange. All right. And Roger, go ahead.
Sure. Good evening. I'd like to start first with just a brief overview of how we got through the standards you guys all know today. I think in 2001, and Ron might be able to fill in the voids here. I'm looking at just bits and pieces I've come across. 2001, I think some fire changes were kind of brought up by the Planning Commission. I think maybe two, three workshops were started. The Fire Defense Board was involved. And the notes I see that it kind of fell off of the planning work schedule because periodic review took precedent over that, and it kind of got shelved. Then 2002, the Biscuit Fire happened. That brought everybody's attention back to some of the changes. I think there was also Senate Bill 360, things like that were bouncing around. There was actually some grant monies that I think the county was able to get to kind of continue with it. And so it picked up again, I think, in 2003, probably 12 or 13 public meetings, open houses, five planning commission meetings till it finally got to the board level. I'm not sure how many meetings it took the board before they finally came to agree and approve what's in the code today. So that's just the background with the where we're at today and how we got here. I guess as David was talking about, everybody sees the Article 76 in the sense of subdivision reviews is where we typically see it. We're kind of taking an overview of the project, a real general that, you know, home sites are feasible, but in the daily application is the part that I guess isn't seen by the Planning Commission, where people come in off the street for an established rural residential lot and want to place a new house or relocate a house. That's where we see the day in and day out Article 76 implications. Residentially, that's probably the easiest where we deal with it. If it's a residential property, single-family homes can be done right at the counter as long as we have a plot plan that demonstrates the 50-foot fuel break we always hear about. They have proof of water, typically as a well report. They have an access permit for public works if they have a legal access, and proof of fire subscription service. We don't have county fire districts except for the Williams or the Illinois Valley, so that would be the other aspect. That's pretty much what we're dealing with day in and day out at the counter. The level that I guess it elevates a bit would be forest dwellings, forest properties. You've probably seen the code. Really, there's kind of two levels. There's other zones, which is a residential, serpentine, things like that. And then it specifically calls out the forest zones. That's where, by virtue of where they're at, they're typically the more susceptible to wildfire. That's where the bigger concerns are. The code stipulates that these structures, and actually all of them, not just a house, but accessory structures, things of that nature, they go through a wildfire safety review, and if they have the slopes and the granitic soils, there's also the erosion control review that goes along with it. Those are done at staff level. Obviously, we don't see them at the Planning Commission level. They're not notice decisions. They're kind of an in-house ministerial type thing where we're just looking at the standards which you've seen in Article 76, verifying they're met, and we issue the development permit. The end product is compliance or certification that you've complied with it. In the residential zone, it's pretty much considered a self-certification. When somebody's looking to get final CFO from the building department, that's when we get prompted to mail out our follow-up, so to speak, or our certificate of compliance request, where they would then, at the residential level, they go through basically a check-off that they've got their fuel break, they've reduced the vegetation, they got at least the 12.5-foot wide driveway, the turnaround's there. And really, it's just taken in at their honor, and we got the paperwork, and our hope is that because they went through that, that's actually been done accomplished on the property, and then C of O is released, and they're off and running. The forest zone is a little bit different. It's kind of along the same lines, but it actually is a minor application, so to speak, where we're requesting information If it's an erosion situation, there is a letter that needs to come from the engineer that the erosion methods have been in place and as planned. And the fire district representatives will send us a letter, typically an email, that they've driven by and they inspected and they're okay with the fire access. It meets their turnaround standards, things like that. And basically pictures demonstrating the fuel break around the structure has been done. They could always, of course, be somebody else's pictures from somebody else's property, but you get the idea. It's not a real intrusive. We're going out inspecting it, aside from the engineers verifying his plan has been put in place and the fire guys saying, yeah, I drove by there. And we have a fire representative. He's one of the gentlemen that we get letters from all the time. That is kind of the Article 76 implementation process here at the county in a small nutshell. So with that, I guess I'd entertain any questions if you had any further comments or concerns or requests about anything else regarding it. But that's it real briefly in a nutshell how we day in and day out implement it across the county.
I have a question. Once again, if you touched on this, what brought this to the attention of the Board of Commissioners to have it reviewed?
Well, originally, the notes I've seen and found through old processes and folders and reports is that it was picked up by the Planning Commission in 2001 for the existing fire Article 76. There was some concerns and some changes. That kind of started it. Then the county's requirement back then for periodic review to go through the code took precedence, so it kind of got dropped, and then it came back after the Biscuit Fire happened.
Well, as I understand, Article 76 was most recently revised in 2005. So it really hasn't been that long. I guess is that what triggered it? Just were there some issues that people were concerned about the Article 76 as it was written?
Well, Ron may be able to chime in on that. I don't know the history. The notes that I read in the old files just say that there were some issues and things that the Planning Commission wanted to bring up to talk about, and then that's when it kind of got sideways till the Biscuit Fire. So I'm not sure what the reasons.
Malcolm, you're actually on that.
Or Malcolm. Malcolm was probably present, too.
Yeah, I was the chairman of the subcommittee. And so I was the primary author of this bill. And, you know, the whole purpose of this LDAC was the commissioners wanted us to look and compare county regulations with state laws and to wherever it made sense. I don't know if they mentioned making sense or not, but wherever we could to fall back to the state level so we had no more restrictive rules than the state.
Okay.
To me, that meant that's fine, but let's not throw out the baby with the bathwater. Let's try to keep some sense in here. And I actually proposed a lot of Article 76 when it was first, I think it was when they first changed it from forest land to everywhere. I think it's everywhere, certainly residential.
Yeah.
And I thought some of the ideas were way too restrictive. And I went to several hearings, and a lot of people were pretty upset with it. And it actually worked out being a pretty good compromise. I wasn't 100% happy with it, and I actually came up with a lot of things. These are primarily my suggestions in here, which I think are reasonable, and I hope that everybody else does. But if you don't, I'm not going to get my feelings hurt.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I just clarified. I thought you were talking about what originally prompted us to get to the 76 we have today, not the current where we're at. Yeah, it's Malcolm and his committee.
Well, I was trying to also say we have to right now because in 2005, I guess, is when we switched over from forest to residential.
Were you a part of the 2001 Planning Commission that brought it up?
No.
Ron, were you? Okay.
Well, Ron's been here forever. He knows everything.
The ultimate answer to your question is this was brought back up by the LDAC trying to revise it so they can.
So there were some complaints from builders. And
yeah.
Oh, okay. One other question. This is probably my own, and I don't know whether this came up. I think it's my own personal pet peeve about Article 76, but I'll state it again anyway. I went to the LDAC committee one of their meetings, and I testified there. But I still am concerned about
the defensible spaces going beyond the owner's property line. And I find that to be really onerous, and in my case it was really onerous because the neighboring property owner was not interested in giving me permission to do that. Did that ever come up for discussion?
I'll ask David, but I don't think that's a requirement under our current zoning. David, they go off.
That's an option. In other words, if you can't meet your fuel break, you have the ability, and Jackson County is common, constantly. I actually brought a fuel break easement over from Jackson County, reworded it to work for Josephine County. That's like an option that you can work out on your own and show you've got your 50-foot or your 100-foot met if you have this fuel break easement. If not, then you're looking at the modification or relocating, things of that nature. So it's not a requirement because obviously we understand that you're not going to be able to go over your neighbor's house and say, look, I need a 50-foot.
Well, yeah, my situation was my neighbor was not interested in giving me an easement or even talking to me.
That's why it's an option.
Option other than just to not do anything. And I guess I finally applied for a variance or
a modification
and was granted that. But that, I don't know, that bugs me just that a property owner should have to go to their neighbor and beg for an easement to create a defensible.
Well, we're not telling you have to. I guess that's
yeah,
not...
Okay.
Let me bring up one other thing. You asked if we'd addressed it, and yes. On the last two pages of the Article 76 section, we suggested complying... Oh, do you want to go through all this one at a time? Or, I don't know.
Yeah.
Or just answer questions?
You know, I think it would be good for the new people on here if we did one of those things. Because I'm new. I know Margaret is.
Has everybody had a chance to read through this stuff?
Yeah.
No?
I read it online, and I didn't print it all out, so I didn't take any notes.
I think I spent about 30 or 45 minutes presenting this to the LDAC when we did it. I don't know if we got that kind of time or not.
My original intent of tonight's workshop was to introduce you to the materials, give you some background. Cameron was kind enough to show up, so if you had any questions for a local fire chief, you could ask him and get familiar with the issues and go into more depth with the actual recommendations at a later time. Due to the time constraint, we've got three major LDAC recommendations to go through tonight, as well as touch on home occupations and wireless.
Okay, so that's a no.
So just look at those last two sheets, and then I'll answer your questions.
So on that point,
Steph,
are we going to... We're going to set a date for continuation of this workshop tonight.
For another workshop in North House,
yes.
Okay.
All right, so do we want to...
Any more questions?
I have a question. It's the storm drain facility is off part and perhaps other great silver bird mentioned the high cost of runoff evaluation. Roger's recollection is that a cost of $10,000 to $15,000 was mentioned. It is a subcommittee thought that this subcommittee thought that a much simpler methodology could be used to significant cost. But then they went on and said, well, maybe we should let developers and engineers determine how complex and expensive the engineer's work should be.
Yeah, we went and had a consultation with Rob and Chuck down at Public Works. And they said, you know, we thought about drawing up some simpler plans ourselves because we agree it could be. But, you know what, he said, the engineers don't have to do this stuff. It costs $10,000 or $15,000. They can do it real easy. And we figured... if their engineers want to charge them an arm and a leg, that's the way it goes. And basically, but when we presented this thing at our meeting, I think Bob Hart and a couple others said, that's just baloney. They won't let us do anything cheaper. So I don't know where to go with that. But that's where we ended up. We just didn't really address it in our recommendations.
Maybe at another workshop, we'll talk more about that.
Yeah.
Are you asking about the cost or just the process? Because to be quite honest with you, $10,000 to $15,000. I don't know where I didn't come up with that number. If that was something somebody had brought up at one point in time. But
okay, I thought it was
that wasn't my number. I have no clue.
I was asking Malcolm.
That was my recollection. It was you. It was probably somebody else. Somebody brought it up, or else I had a nightmare.
So he said a couple people down public works. For a lot less expense, but then, you know, let the engineers charge them if they want. Well, that's just kind of unfair if you ask me. Let's give with a recommendation of the homeowner to give to their engineer so it doesn't cost them $10,000 or $15,000, you know? I mean, if we can do that,
if it even does cost that much,
it'd be better for our economy to build more homes, you know, if people can't afford $10,000.
Engineers need work too, right?
What?
Engineers need work too, but no,
That's a pretty steep piece there.
Well, everything's getting expensive in development, I can tell you that, but I'm sort of required.
Okay, are there any other, without getting too much into the details, are there any other general questions about what Roger has presented tonight? Now let's go on. Do you want to discuss the, what next, the street standards? Or?
James is prepared to discuss Deerwater Ranch.
Okay.
I just, you guys all should have this little handout. There's a front and back on it. This is kind of a quick overview that I did for the LDAP committee during Deer Winter Range. Like I said, it's just an overview. It goes over basically where did the genesis of Deer Winter come from, what ordinance went into effect, and basically on the back page it explains the two tests, the Deer Winter Range test that applications must go through. So on the front page, this whole idea of Deer Winter Range was generated out of the state goals and the county goals. Statewide Planning Goal 5, as well as Josephine County Comp Plan Goal 7. The county shall encourage the identification and preservation of critical deer habitat areas. As a result of the DCC approved ordinance 2006-003 on July 4th, 2006, and the result was the Article 69.2 deer overlay. Having the Deer Winter Range map, I actually brought one in. It's behind Malcolm over here. I can hold it up if you want. Give you an idea of what the Deer Winter Range coverage is. All the dark green is the Deer Winter Range areas, and all the yellow would be considered impacted, meaning it's already developed. So as you can tell, pretty good portion of the county, at least the buildable areas in the county, excluding this half, which belongs to the federal government mostly, just to give you an idea of how much deer winter range we have in the county. As I mentioned, there's two tests. This is on the second page or the back side of that handout. We have two tests with density limitations on them. The first test is known as the fixed study area test. Basically what it is, given a piece of property, we place a 2-square-mile circle over the property, and the density within that circle must be one dwelling per 40 acres, which is equal to a 0.025 density maximum, which is basically a ratio. I have an example. Someone have a question?
Or less, right?
Or less, correct. The example I came up with is if we place this 2-mile circle over piece of property and we have 24 existing dwellings in that study area with 945.5 acres, that's a 0.025. However, adding a new dwelling would put it over that threshold and therefore it would fail that test. In that scenario, then an applicant could move to the second test, or B, which is known as the expanded study area test. A little different concept. On this one, we draw a circle of any diameter which captures 2 square miles of that green stuff on that map. So you basically got a circle, you go out and out, further and further until you capture 2 square miles of the actual deer winter habitat. And then at that point, it's a simple matter of counting the dwellings within that circle. And then we must have less than 32 dwellings in that circle. So that's the second option. I personally have not seen anyone fail an expanded study, meaning that I've seen the fixed study fail. I have not seen an expanded one fail yet in my time here. But there's also another option. If both tests fail, there's the code allows for a text amendment. Basically, you're going to amend the deer winter range on your specific property. There's specific standards and criteria that you have to meet in the deer winter range section of the code that would allow you to amend the deer winter range on your property in this case. Obviously, that's an application, a significant application fee to do that. We're talking about a text amendment, and that's the fees that the board came up with for our ordinance. The last statement there came from the previous planning director. I've only been here so long. He was here much longer, and he can remember of maybe three tests that failed, or three situations that failed, in his time here. They didn't move on. They stopped. They went a different direction. So. One of them, I believe, was a zone change application. So that's my quick overview of what we have right now. This is what we're working with. The LDAC committee has proposed, and I believe the committee involves, let me see here, I believe Jack Schultz was involved with that committee, yes, and Jim Frick was involved. And exhibit three. Okay.
There's two, three.
Go through your package. Yeah. The page before this map.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's the last page of exhibit three, and those include the recommendations of land development advisory.
Exactly. There's their recommendations. Also tonight, I believe I saw Steve Nemo in the back here from Fish and Wildlife. If you have questions on that matter as well, as far as deer winter range goes. And I know they have their own concerns with the way the current code works right now. So that's all I have. If there's more questions, I'll come.
Yeah, is there a significance to this 945.5 habitat acres in your example?
That was just an example that I came up with to make the numbers work out. I was trying to play with the numbers to get a 0.025.
Okay. And then anything to do with the size?
No,
the
it doesn't. It doesn't.
James,
yes.
I recall reading online the recommendations, and I think what just a brief summary of the recommendations are. The LDAC is recommending to do away with the deer winter range regulations, right? For the they divided the town into two herds, the higher herd and the lower herd. For the lower herd,
mm-hmm.
They're recommending to do away with the restrictions.
That's my understanding, yeah. And I know Fish and Wildlife can chime in on some of that too as well. Right.
I thought that was interesting about the two herds. I hadn't thought of herds
mm-hmm.
on such a large scale.
Yeah. When we originally did this ordinance, there wasn't a lot of data out there, from my understanding from Fish and Wildlife.
Yeah. So some of the summary is based on a presentation I gave. Myself and some other ODFW members and a lot of the local Oregon Hunters Association volunteering with us to put radio collars on deer and then watch where they go. And some of, there's different behaviors out there. Some deer tend to be more resident, some deer tend to be more migratory. I think that some of my statements got maybe a little misrepresented in the sense that there's not necessarily two discrete herds, although in some cases they do behave that way. But I would be happy, and I mentioned before, to give that presentation again if in the work of the committee. If they want more information, be happy to come and give you what we have, and happy to answer any questions tonight. And we do have some concerns with the code,
in regards to what James mentioned as far as it's really, in a lot of ways, not functioning to protect habitat, because one of the things it doesn't do is when it draws that circle and starts counting residences, say you own 10 5-acre parcels within that circle. None of them have houses on it yet, but it's a 5-acre piece of property with low timber value land, which a lot of winter range is. Presumably, those 5-acre pieces will probably get houses eventually, but they're ignored in the context of the equation that's calculated. So there's some issues there just as far as how it functions, where we've had some concerns. But mostly tonight, I'm just here to be a resource and to answer questions, and I'm kind of going off. So if you guys have questions, I'm here. Otherwise, I'll sit back down for right now.
Just to continue, Mike, do you support the recommendation of the LDAC or not?
No, not to. Well, and I guess I was a little confused because there's sort of two different documents here. One seems to have a more narrow recommendation of limiting where the winter range is and then reducing the density that is allowed. And then the other one seems to say to get rid of it completely. So I guess one of my questions would be, what really is the recommendation that's moving forward?
Right. Very good. Thanks a lot.
Sure.
Any other questions or things?
Probably. Comments? In the LDAC, when he did his presentation, the only study that was done in Little Gray Back, there wasn't any study of anywhere else in the valley. Oh. So it was kind of a one-sided, where they tracked, and it was a small number to begin with, but there was nothing in the potential home site.
And I guess that's where I would really, if there's opportunity to give the full presentation, might be good, because we had Deer, Pollard, and Shan Creek, and we had some up on Granite Hill and Savage Creek, and then by Boland Lake, and then Munger Butte. And so there's a few different areas, but the bulk of our deer were in the Illinois Bat, or the Grayback area. But anyway.
No. I'd like to just make one observation. I think you were there when you were discussing this after your presentation. You had, it's not your fault, you had a very limited amount of data because it costs a lot of money, you say, and I can imagine to put radio collars on deer and go around and track them, and some of them died, so some of your numbers were like 4 or 5 in the whole group, so a difference of one deer would become a 20% increase or decrease, so
yeah,
some of us didn't feel like the data was compelling enough to justify this kind of expense to all the developers.
Okay.
We also felt that if, even though it wasn't statistically significant, the presentation did seem, the trends that it indicated were that the deer who actually do exhibit what was called the migratory behavior, where they actually are non-resident, where they do actually come down the mountain,
right,
most of those do tend to live at the much higher altitudes, and that's why most of them were on Grayback, because that is the highest elevation in the county. Over in Jackson County, where they have higher elevations, is more of that kind of behavior. But here in Josephine County, there's really very little area except for Grayback where the deer actually do, there are significant numbers that actually do migrate down into what's protected deer winter range. The deer winter range, when it was first designated, was drawn based on elevations rather than any kind of actual documented behavior. When the behavioral studies were actually done, they didn't justify the amount of the county that's actually set aside for deer winter range. And that's why the committee came up with the recommendation that most of this deer winter range doesn't actually need to be used for deer winter range. And I think that there was an area, I forget where it was, that the committee actually did recommend to keep the deer winter range because it's a sensitive area as well as Grayback. But over most of the county, it really didn't seem, the study that was done did not seem to justify it. Even if you don't take into account that the numbers from the study were statistically insignificant, it's the trends that were shown didn't justify the winter range.
What is insignificant?
Well, we're talking about the numbers are so few because the cost is so high. I don't recall the actual numbers. This was several months ago, but they were, you know, we're talking maybe dozens.
Yeah,
Phil, we captured 48 deer, I think it was, and released them with radio collars, but then you have to have deer that survive or at least retain the collar for a year. So I think by the time we had deer that were alive, at least in one summer and one winter season with collars, it was like 31 deer that we had collared. And they're exactly right. It's tremendously labor-intensive and financially burdensome to, you know, capture them. You're putting a lot of effort in, and then you have to follow them in an airplane in the wintertime flying around in the mountains. So you also have sort of narrow flight windows that you can do, too. But, yeah, that was a good, I think, general description of the way the study went. But 31 deer were the final number of what we used in our analysis.
Thank you.
I know where I live, a few miles south of town here. I have a permanent population. My wife's got them all named. They never leave. they're just there all year round.
We've got a population in our neighborhood too, about 20 of them, and they go down Hamilton and on the empty property, and then come back to ours in the lane.
I don't know.
We've got them named too.
I'm not clear on one thing on your summary here. On the very first item, as far as the state of Oregon's planning goals, with regard to this deer winter range topic, it's the link between the state's goals and our ordinance, the way it is today, is simply from this one planning goal number 5, right?
That's where it starts.
There's no specific mention of deer winter ranges in that goal. But the interpretation locally is the deer winter range topic fits in that spot and among the state's planning goals.
Correct.
I think that's an accurate.
Yeah. That's correct.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Any other comments or questions among the commissioners? I wanted to point out one thing, or get clear on another thing. I noticed that two of our commissioners actually served on the committees.
Three, actually.
Oh, three? Who's the... Okay, I see Ron Wright, and I see Malcolm Drake. I don't see...
I actually was on the Deer Winter Range Committee, but I came in late because I wasn't there when the committee was first formed, but I started right afterwards.
Okay, and are there any other commissioners, just for my information, are they among us who were actually not on the committees but are on LDAC itself?
No.
Okay.
So I'm sorry, I didn't mean the three of us were on that committee. We were all on LDAC.
Okay. We're all on different.
I'm at the subcommittee. I'm talking about the subcommittee.
Yeah, we were on different.
We're all on different subcommittees.
Okay.
So three among us were on the subcommittees, and those three are also LDAC members. And there's no other LDAC members among us.
There's three LDAC members
in the audience only.
All right. Okay. Good.
And which were you on the subcommittee, Brian? I don't remember.
Yeah.
Okay. We're all on different subcommittees. Then I take it.
All right. Thank you very much, James. Mm-hmm. Let's see, what's the third topic? Food standards.
So I was on the road standards.
To discuss the proposal on road standards, again, from a staff perspective, and maybe some differences between what we have now and what would be the effect of what's proposed in the LDAC recommendations. Rob Brandis is here, he's the Public Works Director. Nora Schwartz is also in the audience. And and on that particular subcommittee of LDAC, Ron Wright was a member. Were you a member of the recommendations?
Halfway. Okay. So I'll let Rob kind of take it from here.
Okay.
Well, I'm not sure how. I have not been to many planning commission meetings, so I'm not sure how you want to handle it. I would, give you the quick backstory is from a purely construction standpoint, we don't have a lot of skin in the game in terms of, you know, what's dictated for cost and everything else, but we would also be remiss in our duty as a department to not be looking at the long term, to say, well, you know, what's likely to happen 10 years, 20, 20 years, 30 years down the road if we constrict ourselves to something that can't be easily expanded or built upon later on, because development will happen long beyond this committee and long beyond me or anyone else. We just don't want somebody to be at a point where 20 years down the road they say, well, why the heck can't I get into here? And we say, well, because, yeah, there's that long, windy road that is undersized for where it gets to. So I understand I'm trying to split the needle here a bit in meeting the committees, the LDAC's desire to change the code where applicable, but I'd also, and a lot of times these are non-maintained roads, but we do have, I think, as a body, we've got some in-house professional experience that kind of warrants us weighing in on whether it be bridge load ratings or road width or turnout spacing. So maybe the best way is to just open it up.
If I may,
sure,
let me chime in here real quick to preface a lot of this. You know, back before you were director, mm-hmm. and I don't know how long the road was starting before that. They used to have a lot of developments, and they'd go in and they'd build the road. They'd approve it. Developer'd come in and build it. A year later, the road would wash out. That's where the premise of all the bulk of the standards came in and why that we require bonds anymore. So they build it to code instead of building it for show and taking the money and running it. So
right.
I want to make sure that we understood that. So
good point. I guess, and maybe along that same vein would be, we'd want to make sure that if a development was happening and there was a way that they could spend 5% more on the road but leave it that much more available to bring to full-blown county standards 5 years down the road, we'd want to make sure that everybody knew the kind of the whole menu available, because I'd hate to have somebody, you know, I think I used the example in one of my memos, a guy that came in was excited, said, hey, we think we can get our road up to county standards, and he'd say $30,000, and I said, how long's your road? And he said, oh, it's about a mile. I was like, well, all right, okay, come, you're 10% of the way there, kind of a thing. So I want to make sure that, at least in this process, the bigger picture, longer term is heard, to keep people's options open if they do choose to develop to full standard later on.
I have scanned these recommendations, and I don't remember each and every one regarding the street standards, but do you agree with all the recommendations, some of the recommendations, or do you violently oppose some of the recommendations? I just wonder where you stand on where the Department of Public Works stands on the recommendations.
I think, you know, yeah, it'd be tough to categorize them all together. I think the couple that stood out for us, one is, as the county engineer pointed out, was that overlap between the two similar classifications, the on the non-maintains, just seemed redundant. Another one we talked about extensively in the LDAC was the bridge standards, given the additional, not the additional, the no net savings by building a less than full standard bridge, struck us as not a real good idea. And I think we also had, I don't know if Maura has, have you showed the displays yet for the, they've got that, okay. I think that was the other one, with some of the fire safety stuff specifically, you know, the length between turnouts, some of the radius and things like that.
Just to let you know, I know you just came in, I believe. What we've decided to do is make this a general overview tonight.
Great.
I'm not getting into the nitty-gritty.
Sure.
Still the following meeting.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to get an overview of how you felt about these.
Sure. My take was, I think the LDAC did their due diligence. It was you know, a good committee from what I could see, and I think they got a pretty broad range of viewpoints. In my opinion, could have used some refining, sure. And you know, I'd be curious to hear what the fire has to say. But all in all, I mean, I think the process went well. Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay. That's great. Any questions of the public works director?
Rob.
Oh.
Can I interject?
Sure. Yes, Mrs. Nora Schwartz, she's our service officer.
I just wanted to. I just wanted to throw up. Gee, what a choice of words.
Right.
Freudian slip, what can I say?
Stay away from the big news.
Sorry, no projectiles this evening. I just wanted to do a quick little illustration of one of the concerns that our county engineer had that I think might help bring to light kind of a worst-case scenario, but something that maybe we need to think about, because sometimes worst-case scenarios happen. Now, whether we're, if we're talking about the restricted residential road, which now can carry 5 lots, we have a proposal before us to maximize that out to 10 lots. So here you've got your restricted residential road, which is a one-lane road with an open throat and a cul-de-sac at the end, right? We're all familiar with that. This isn't going to be pretty, but, you know, you get the idea. Okay, and there's the road. Now, instead of this one-lane road carrying only 5 lots, which is the restriction now, we could be talking about a road of an undefined length. There are no restrictions that I'm aware of per se for that, but instead it would be carrying 10 lots. So we've got, however this would draw out, but what we have to remember here is if the minimum width of the lot is 300 feet, I think we can all multiply that out. I think we're talking about what, like 4 football fields? If you can visualize that, that's a heck of a long way for if you had a really terrible situation, like what if wherever this is being built, and we know that in this situation in Josephine County, we're running out of flat land. We've got more and more hilly terrain that we have to deal with. What if we have a wildfire? This would be a terrible thing. What if this is a road that we have to remember would be owner maintained through a road maintenance agreement that is normally enforced between these various individuals who have an interest in it? So another worst case scenario is one, we've got the wildfire. What if people are not really keeping up on it and we've got maybe 15 years of vegetation that really should have been taken better care of? We've got people that are panicked. Emergency access trying to come in while these people are trying to get out. What is that really going to look like? It could really spell disaster. And again, just to reiterate, that was one of the scenarios that Chuck DeJonvert, county engineer, was really, really concerned about. It sounds like a great idea, and we've got the option for inter-visible turnouts, but the reality could be not everybody's going to make it. So he just wanted me to share that.
So what would you propose?
Well, I think one of the issues is do we really want to do this expansion to 5 lots with a single lane road?
10 lots.
From 5 to 10.
Yeah.
I think basically we're really concerned about that expansion with it staying at a single lane road. Now, the flip side is if that became a private road, then we don't really have a dog in the fight. But as a public entity with public safety in mind, we at least have the responsibility to say, does it really sound like a good idea?
Right.
So that's, you know, just a viewpoint.
Okay. A question, just as a clarification. I was trying to read through that stuff yesterday, and I had the hardest time with the roads. It seemed like there was more confusion in my mind. You can have, in other words, we're allowed to build a subdivision with 5 lots with a private road, or no?
If the subdivision is a particular variety or animal, which is the plant unit development,
right, okay,
that is a subdivision that allows a private road, although certainly you could put in a public road if you want to, but there's where the option comes in.
Okay, so and a general subdivision, this restricted residential road that you talked about would be a public road.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
The owners would maintain it. Okay.
Public access, owner maintained,
okay,
versus private access, owner maintained.
Okay.
In fact, it really is just land, a giant easement when you get to a private road, because no one else can go up there.
Okay, that helps me a lot. I was trying to sort through all the options, and I couldn't quite figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And the proposal from LDAC is to go to allow 10 lots with a restricted residential road.
Yes.
Right, okay.
Yes.
That's what I thought I read, but I wanted to be
mm-hmm.
clear.
A private road could be more than 10 lots.
A private road could be more than 10 lots, yeah.
And a private road could be, if I read this information correctly, like a foot less in width than even our restricted residential.
The recommendation is that the private road serves more than 10 lots of parcels. The road width will have a minimum driving surface of 20 feet.
Right. And
once you got beyond 10, they widen it.
And if it's 10, they're asking for 12, which is a foot less than our restricted.
When these things actually happen, they're not, if it's built on a hill, the axis is not necessarily straight, is it? It could be curved.
Sure.
Well, the axis has to meet the road at a 90-degree angle, but then once it enters the lot and becomes the actual driveway, it can meander all over the place. And sometimes they do. If the building site is way back, that's where they have the best view, then you've got this windy driveway that finally makes it.
So an emergency, that could be a real factor.
Well, I suppose it could be,
sure. And the actual length of the road could be different because we've got skinnier lots, wider lots, so it's kind of hard to predict, but that would be the 5 times 300 on each, 5 lots on each side.
And it's just understood that it's 20 feet.
Over 10 lots.
So
nine lots, for example, would be 12 feet.
Which is an interesting diversion from what we're talking about with the restricted residential road. We're talking about a single lane road on the one hand, owner maintained, that could carry 10 lots. But when you get to the private road, if you want 10 lots, you've got to have 20 feet in width. So how does that balance?
That's more than 10 lots, wasn't it?
Well, more than 10 lots. Okay, so one more lot. But suddenly you have to have a much wider road. So how do you justify that?
Well, you've got the same thing now. It's 5 lots, right? If you're going to have more than 5 lots, you've got to have a wider road bed.
And
if you have 6, it's got to be 2 lanes. 5.
Right.
Whatever Bosky said, eventually somebody will be the last one in the door. Yes.
Right.
Yeah. How do you get the biggest?
Yeah, I want to comment. I've got, I think, 6 pages of suggestions and questions, comments, and whatnot on the road thing. And I'm not going to go through them all tonight, obviously, but I think, we voted 5-4. Actually, I wasn't a voting member of that committee at the time. I was the backup, but we voted 5-4 in favor. It was pretty close, and I felt like there was a lot of areas that we could have put more time in, and I think somebody needs to put more time in if we're going to get a good product out of this. One of the things that was mentioned by, I think Michael Howard might have been somebody from Public Works, was that right now if you do a subdivision, you have a road over, 800 feet long, it has to be a loop. Is that the right number? Anybody?
I don't know off the top of my head.
I think it's...
It's more than that. 12, isn't it?
I thought it was 1,300.
12 or 36.
Over 800 feet.
Okay, 800 feet.
Which,
thank you. So one of the concerns I hear saying is, okay, you're going to have these, if you have an average subdivision, you're going to have 1,200 foot or even a little bit more without a loop road. So I would think, this is one thing we can address. Say, okay, if you're going to do a private road over 800 feet, you've got to do a loop road. And I would suggest if it's a one-lane road, make it one-way. So that everybody's used to going the same direction. So you got the fire trucks coming in one end and keep bleeding out the other. But this is the kind of thing I'm saying we could hammer out if we wanted to.
I just got one thing. Do people do that in the fire camera?
There's no one's going to go one way.
Impossible.
They're going to go both ways. Quickest way out.
You've got to go whatever.
No, you could be right. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, go take the shortest way out.
The shortest way out, and it's going to be chaos.
On the subcommittee, I voted against it. I was one of the ones that voted no. And there was some good progress made, but there was some things that just could have been ironed out. Most of this, if we could just sit down and cross the T's and dot the I's, I think we can come to a middle road. And that opportunity, as far as I'm concerned, was not taken advantage of. So I think there's some things that need to be finalized a little more.
So that would either fall on our shoulders or reconvene
the at this point.
Yeah. Right. Well, Yeah,
I think that's a fair assessment. I think the committee had it. We had it hemmed in. I think it was in just saying how we're gonna brand the cattle now that they're in there. And maybe, I don't know how other counties have for standards, but there's some options for even some sliding scales. A lot of this stuff kind of got into real binary all or nothing. And maybe there's some ways you can account for saying if it's 8, you can go to 8 lots. If it's this change in elevation, I don't know. And maybe that would get real esoteric after a while, but a lot of the decisions, yeah, seem like they kind of got to be real all or nothing. Maybe that's the stuff we could hammer out with a little more time between the two departments and input from the commission.
And I think we can. And the other thing that, if I don't lose my train of thought here, we're so close to getting somewhere. And,
I'm going to come back. Okay. Come back to the
train of thought that was very specific in where we were headed and where we needed to go.
Are there any other questions on this topic for Vivian or Ron? Or?
Oh.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah, it didn't take long. One of the big concerns is, and Harold did a wonderful job of running it, and there was a little too much of the I have this problem, I have this lot, I have this, versus a county coming together and trying to get a code. It was a little more individual personages coming in with specific. And it was okay to have, you know, instances and references, but sometimes I think it got a little too I instead of county. And things got a little one-sided.
You mean among the committee, subcommittee members themselves?
Yeah. So. There was quite a few, and I won't mention any names just because we don't need to, but we just want to keep that in mind also, that this is a code that will apply to everybody in the county. So there's always going to be an individual circumstance somewhere along the road. Somebody's not going to get what they wanted every time, and I don't know any way to always achieve everybody getting what they want.
Life doesn't want that.
Yeah. So but I think it needs to be a little neutral.
I have a question of Nora or Public Works Director. It's related to this topic, but it's not exactly on this topic. With regard to roads and new small subdivisions, does the county ever accept road easements? Not in this context, necessarily. We're talking about length and but easements at all. For a road, or is it always a fee title dedication to the county?
I think it's always going to have to be dedicated. I can't think of a situation where it wouldn't.
Yeah, I'm thinking of say four lots split or five lot splits, and everybody's right at 5 acres until you subtract the road. And now now the number of lots have to be reduced. And if it was just an easement, people could maintain their 5 acres.
Right.
And the road would not subtract from their minimum acreage.
The short answer is no.
Okay, I know in Santa Clara County, California, it's okay. Then I just wondered about this world where I live now.
Well, I think historically one of the big concerns has been observations, especially, I suppose, on the planning side, less so that Public Works would hear about, but that easements are great on paper, but then individuals have issues, and once those issues come to light, things can get really, really nasty, and it creates a lot of problems. And when you first are starting out, you're talking about those particular individuals involved in that easement,
right,
and their relationship. Well, the dynamics change every time somebody sells a house, and it doesn't take too much, at least this seems to be the observation again, for things to go sideways. So it's kind of opening a Pandora's box, because what do you do? I mean, it can be Hatfields and McCoys. Next thing you know, somebody's out there with a gun. I mean, it happens, as everybody knows. And so I think that's one of the primary reasons why we shy away from the easements, because it's kind of an accident waiting to happen. At least that's been the observation.
Well, I was talking about an easement to the county for the road and for road maintenance, so that the county maintained the road within the easement. It's just that everybody gets to maintain their fee title acreage.
I don't think the county would want to maintain it if we didn't hold it.
Yeah.
And the tough part we're seeing for whatever reason more and more is even on public right-of-ways on some of these non-maintains and all, people putting up gates and things like that. I mean, it's getting harder and harder for the county to even be able to assert its ability to go in there and take care of them. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
One of the planners could answer this better than I can, but there is a provision when you're doing a subdivision, a certain amount of the acreage can be taken up by roads. I don't remember the percent. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to have exactly the full acreage.
That's correct.
Oh, the open space counts.
Oh, well, that, oh, I see. All right. So that answers my question. I just
for PUD.
No, not for
PUD.
Your parcel can be deficient the area that the right-of-way is taken out. So in other words, like you're talking about, if you had butt-to-butt 5-acre lots, you brought a road through there, each guy gives 25 feet, for example. That 25 feet, the length of your property, you're allowed to account for that deficiency.
Oh.
Now you're 4.95 acres.
Right.
The code doesn't allow for that.
And that's done without an easement.
Exactly. No. You're giving up that right-of-way.
Okay, good. Well, that's good.
So there's a provision for those types of questions.
Great. There's some discussion of the private road standards, and the memo is not entirely current, so I want to give that caveat when you read it. It's from October 5th of 2010. It's from Michael Snyder to the LDAC. And it addresses some of the issues, but you're going to have to read that with a filter and look at what was actually proposed by LDAC, because that memo was written before the LDAC recommendations came out. But there's some discussion about what the county current uses for road easements and some of the pros and cons of using easements, private road versus public. And just as background information, I think it's helpful, but I want to remind you of that was written before the recommendations came out. All right.
Thank you. Anything else?
I guess one final note on roads, and because we've already had the longest drive tonight, Cameron Ismailia is here from IV Fire District, and I just wanted to invite the commission that so he doesn't have to make too many of these drives up on an evening Grant's Pass. If you have questions for him regarding fire issues or private roads, some of the road standards and how that might affect the fire district.
I'll ask the same question of you that I've asked everybody else. Do you have any huge issues with any of the recommendations in the report?
I just have a couple issues with the weight limits on everything.
Okay, the
50,000. Yeah, they're just a little too light for our equipment. Even our equipment with mutual aid should be at least 60,000 pounds.
And it's actually come up recently, right? Samarkand was the one that's...
Well, Samarkand, we're still waiting on it.
Okay.
It actually cleared 80,000 pounds. They just got it on okay. top.
Do you recall what the... Well, I should ask them. Do you recall what the subcommittee, why they didn't take a...
I wasn't... I'm new on the job, so I don't know what the reasoning was. A lot of districts have it up to 75,000 pounds because of the aerial apparatus. I just want to be able to get my water tenders on to the location without losing
anything else.
The turnouts, the distance on the turnouts are up to 800 feet. Fire code actually has 400 feet before thinning it or doubling it.
Yeah.
So,
Peggy had her hand up to
it. Yeah, I do recall that there was some discussion of that and the cost of increasing the standards to support the amount of weight. So I don't recall what it was. That was like my first day on the LDAC that this was discussed.
I do recall there was a claim made by one of the members of the public that to increase the standards from 50,000 to 80,000 would increase the cost of the bridge, talking bridges by 50% approximately, which seemed real unreasonable to me. And I know Rob and Chuck came up with some figures more like 5 or 10 or 15%, which sounds a lot more reasonable.
If at all.
For those some instances, even less. But
who submitted the 50% number?
I think that was Bob.
That was Bob Hart.
Oh, I see.
But the other thing is, there's if we put up bridges that are only 50,000 pounds, you can't drive most well drilling rigs in there, concrete trucks.
Potentially front-end garbage, front-load garbage trucks.
Yeah, front-load garbage trucks. I think it's not a good idea.
Right. Yeah. But
now we're getting into the details again.
Yeah. If I may, from that, that's what the big discussion was. That's what the LDAC was complaining predominantly. The cost analysis was not done at that point. It's more thorough now. The cost on a 30,000 bridge isn't going to be a big deal to get that fire truck across your property.
Okay.
And then I had fire trucks across Manitou a couple years ago, and I thank God they got across that.
But I don't want the bridge.
I got a bridge that supports it, obviously. And, you know, that fire was in my, both times the fires were on I-5, fire trucks were in my backyard. So,
yes, behind you, I'm sorry.
Critical issue.
Right now we had Samarkand that didn't meet the current requirements, and the bridge was in need of repair, and there was a couple of property owners that were very upset because I wouldn't give them fire protection. Uh-huh. So that's something that's going to upset the whole process also.
How did you know the bridge was substandard?
The hole in it?
Well, I
looked for some kind of verification.
Yeah.
From an engineer somewhere, I couldn't find anything. I asked them to produce something. They said they didn't have anything, so I told them to get an engineer.
Good.
How much you're putting away again?
My biggest water tender is 60,000 pounds. So Grass Pass has aerial apparatus that is upwards of 75,000.
Yeah.
So if we did need to use them, we'd have to strategically place them, obviously, because the roads are going to...
Keep in mind that there's a joint intergovernmental agreement between the departments, so if a fire breaks out, any one of them could be there. So
Eugene,
it's not
would be
specific
down
to IV.
You had a question?
Well, I was just going to... Yeah, I think it's the all-or-nothing nature of the bridge as well. If you have a bridge that's not to load, you can't just say, let's go throw another slab on top and bring it up, whereas if the road's a little narrow... Maybe you got to get a cat up there and you tear up one of the roadside ditches, but you can get to where you need to get. The bridge is really, once it's in, it's in, and you can't add a little bit of money and bring it up to standard. It seems like the worst place to skimp in development to me.
Right. I might be really way off base here, but in my neighborhood, I thought there was only 8 houses on the street, side of them, but there's actually a whole bunch of them up in the woods. You go over those little bridges that are over the irrigation ditches.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they've been patched and repatched and go around on dirt roads to get to a really nice house up the hill.
Mm-hmm.
How would a fire truck get over that? I think they're wider than those bridges are.
I don't know about the width. The length is going to be just because that bridge is less than 20 feet. It's not actually even a bridge at that point. It's a structure that's not under the same guidelines and everything for bridges. But as far as the width, I don't know how wide the tenders are.
How wide are your trucks?
The drive tires are going to be just about the same as on all the trucks. It's going to be about 8 foot. It's just the body is going to be wider if you get on bigger apparatus.
We'll measure
my. We usually get out, and most of the operators are pretty familiar with what they can drive over. They'll get out and evaluate, and if they don't feel safe, they're staying on this side.
Okay, any more comments or questions from the commissioners? Standards. Okay, thank you all. We'll hope to see you again when we get into the nitty-gritty detail.
Sounds good.
One thing I wanted to raise to the commission's attention. You should have a copy of a schedule in your package. And while we've got some resource folks here in the room that may be interested in this as well, as I said at the beginning of this, our initial plan this evening was just to introduce the topic to you, give you a chance to, now having heard some of the discussion, go back and read some of the materials, and do another workshop, and maybe explore some of the issues in more depth. And with that calendar in front of you, I'd like to, if we can, get some tentative dates in front of us. As to when the next workshop might be, and that for the benefit of the audience as well. We came here to listen to some of these issues.
You got my email. For what it's worth, I'm open. So.
I have a November 2nd meeting, I think, on the cell tower, don't I? Who else is on the cell tower?
Well, November 2nd says
December 8th.
Well, yeah. But I think
yes, you did just get an email, but it's not pertinent to this.
And the 31st is a Monday, November 7th is a Monday, November 14th is a Monday, November 21st is a Monday.
How about the 7th? Time to read it and
14?
Are we going to have a separate workshop on each of the proposals, or are we going to try and do them all in one night like tonight?
Good question. I can imagine that it's going to take several nights.
If you want to allot
one a night,
a certain bulk of one workshop for one topic and maybe a smaller bulk for another topic, we can do that, whatever you folks would like. The gentleman from Fish and Wildlife offered a presentation. I don't know if Cameron from Fire has anything more you want to contribute to his presentation, or just maybe attend? Tell us a date and what you'd like to discuss and how much time you think it'll take, and we'll schedule it.
I have a question.
Sure.
It seems like it would be sensible to do a little round robin suggestions to each other on email, but I suspect it's illegal under the open meeting laws. Is that right?
We should do it here tonight.
Yes. No, I'm just talking about different issues. You know, like I've got all these issues about the fire, the road standards that I would love to send out to everybody, but not if it's going to be in.
If you can forward those to me,
okay.
I will send them, and we'll send them to the committee.
Okay.
And that goes out to you just like your packets do.
Okay.
It's not subject to open meeting law.
You're just not allowed to reply all.
Right.
So then it would be subject to open meeting law.
Exactly.
When is Thanksgiving? 24th.
Are we looking at the 14th?
14th, and as far as which topic, I don't have a preference, unless any of the commissioners do, but I think we might consider staff's availability in this decision of which topic to take first, which is the most difficult.
Is the street standards the most difficult?
I think, as I remember,
Public Works just offered I could send them an email, so somebody left the room. Fair game.
So the 14th will be street?
All right, let's do the road, the street standards on the 14th.
This is a workshop, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
So a little more detail, probably some more maps. I would talk to Rob Brandis and Nora Schwartz about bringing some better drawings and give you some examples and maybe even some plats. We could bring some subdivision plots that have been approved and then overlay what the road standards would look like with the proposal of LDAC on a real life situation. I think that would be able to.
How long are we going to meet? 2-3 hours?
Generally, we set aside 2 hours for these workshops. But you want to set aside an hour for road standards alone, or?
I'd say 2 hours.
Well, like we did the whole meeting?
Like we just mentioned, yeah, I think the whole meeting.
Yeah. Okay. We'll set aside 2 hours, and if we feel like going home earlier. Then
David,
can
we
revise the date? Harold,
David, yeah.
Oh, that meets on the 14th already, and you got 3 members.
Oh, they do.
2 members. Thank you,
Bill. 2 members. Until like next January or something.
I would like to suggest whatever date we do this.
How about the 21st?
Fine with me.
Yeah. There may be staff people or commissioners that are on vacation that Thanksgiving week.
When is this whole thing you have to be wrapped up? Is there any kind of deadline?
We don't have an actual deadline, but the first one to the commissioners in June.
Extension.
They finally gave us direction, Harold, do you recall? Two or three weeks ago, they finally gave us direction to move forward on this.
Okay.
So it's
there's no urgency.
It's been sitting in the hopper for a while. And
I actually think that there is some urgency on this because the LDAC committee has been meeting for
almost 3 years, I think.
For almost 2 years, I think it is, on this. And the recommendations were actually given to the commissioners back in June. So this has been a very, very slow process, and I would like to actually see it expedited. Since the 7th is 2 weeks away, and we're just going to be attacking one recommendation at a time, it seems like 2 weeks might be enough time to read one recommendation, so I would propose that we meet on the 7th.
Yeah, because as you get in more into the holiday time frame,
it's
going to be
a little
more
difficult.
I'm okay with the 7th.
Okay. Let me check with Public Works staff, if they're not here, and see if that's enough time for them. assuming perhaps that it's not, what would be your second preference for
a topic
to cover? We'll stick with the 7th, but maybe we could switch to Deer Winter Range. And
you can give that preference.
Okay. Road standards is first preference, and second?
Deer.
Deer.
Anything.
Yeah, I'd like to suggest that we also just leave 5 or 10 or 15 minutes at the end, David, for if people have specific issues that they just say, here, let's think about this till the next meeting on one of the other topics. You know, so we can focus on road. If somebody thinks of something. You know.
Oh, I think so.
And David, how soon will we know if Public Works can make the 7th date so that, because people will be wanting to have time to
tomorrow morning.
And that'll be sent out to everybody.
I'll send out an email to Rob and Nora and check with them, and I'll hear back right away.
So we're tentatively the 7th.
We're definitely the 7th, but we're definitely the 7th.
We're tentative for road standards and maybe deer.
Oh, okay.
Road standards doesn't work. And I'll check with Steve Namala as a backup if that's
correct.
6
p.m. here?
Yes.
And then... do we want to schedule the others now out through the...
No, you're not going to want to schedule going into the holiday.
I think we're off on another sheet of paper off to the 7th meeting.
Thanksgiving is the 20th.
The 24th.
Oh, no, that's the
21st is the Monday before and the 28th is the Monday after. You know, we have a hearing on December 5th. Could we have a workshop before that? We often have workshops before the hearing. And then another on the...
That's a good idea, just for an hour or so.
Sure. And another on the 12th.
The deer station.
Okay.
Well, Steve, if he comes, his presentation takes on close to an hour.
Well, short sure. Presentation...
No. Being through the first presentation, I'll volunteer to Steve can shorten. Harold, do you think we need to sit through that whole thing again?
there wasn't really all that much. There was not an hour's worth of content, in my opinion.
Steve's a great guy and everything, but the presentation had no effect in Greater Grants Pass for the rest of the county if you weren't on Grayback.
I concur with that.
So I think you have kind of a... Use him as a reference, but I don't think you need a presentation.
Okay.
So we'll make it up, and one's not required. So.
December 5th. Okay.
December 5th. Workshop. We'll deal with their winter range, and Steve can answer questions.
With any luck at all, we could maybe have wiped out all three topics by that time. Or not.
Without it.
How
about
the rest of it, Jim?
Yeah, we'll get there.
And then could we do the other one on the 12th before the hearing? Article 76? Yeah.
That's going to be a
good night. I don't think that's enough time.
So you want to do it on December
12th? I'd like to hold off on that.
I would do one on
the 12th. The 12th is, if it goes, that's going to be a big night. And if it, if cell towers, if we're not ready for the text amendment hearing, and that is a tentative date that has not been advertised yet. If we're not ready for that, then we'll let you know via email. And maybe we'll do a workshop.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, that would work.
And we do have to advertise the workshops.
We're doing the 7th for sure at 6 p.m., right?
Yeah.
Depends on whether we're going to do roads or deer winter for that. We'll know tomorrow. Then we will be doing a workshop on the 5th at 6 p.m. before the hearing.
That
correct?
Will be at Ann Bastard.
Yeah. Right.
And then the 12th, we'll only have a workshop if the hearing is canceled again.
The 12th?
Right. That's a tentative workshop date.
Okay.
Thank you. All right. Back to our agenda. Item 3, review of policy regarding home occupations. I'd like to ask, Dave, would you mind explaining your...
Passing around
to
everyone here.
We need
to the chair, you get a copy of it.
As Dave will explain, we need to look for two volunteer commissioners to chair a vice chair a committee that Dave will now explain to us.
you first saw home occupations brought to you in a memo in August 29th. Businesses are expanding in the rural area. Some of them are in conflict with their neighbors. Some of them are in conflict with each other. Those permitted and those not. We want to provide incentives to people to have home businesses. That's really where the economy is headed these days. We want to encourage them. At the same time, we don't want to create impacts to their neighbors. So we discussed that on August 29th. There was quite a breadth of comments from the Planning Commission, as you recall. And I went back to the board and discussed it with both Commissioner Castanella and Commissioner Hare. And they were thinking that a subcommittee from the Planning Commission might be a way to flush out some of the issues and get us all on the same page before we went to a hearing. This is a county-initiated text amendment. So I also spoke with Stan and Don Moore, and we kicked around the idea of a subcommittee. And I have a suggestion here, which is that the membership of that subcommittee be one member from the Small Business Development Center. I've had some conversations with David Talley from SBDC, and he's in favor of this. Would likely be one of our members. One member of the current home occupation business permit holder. We have 72 permits out there right now. We've had some contact with these folks, and we'll go down the list and make a few phone calls and maybe offer one of them to be on the subcommittee and talk about the conditions. Another member that we're suggesting beyond the subcommittee would be Nanette Chase, who's our code administrator. She is the code enforcement officer, as you know her. She goes out and reviews these. Here's the complaints, sees the businesses, that sort of thing. And then two members of the Planning Commission, one the chair, one the vice chair of the committee. So in the absence of one, the other could take over that chairmanship duties. Staff by myself, Ann as recording secretary, and Valerie Montague, who's written several of the home occupation permits we have. That's my recommendation to you.
And that was easy.
Yeah.
Anyone else? Any other commissioner would like to?
Like arm wrestle or something?
This one's yours. They can decide who's chair and vice chair at the time, right? During the committee.
At the meeting.
And the committee itself can elect its own chair. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm trying to do.
Yes.
Okay.
I'll open the first meeting and they can write it out.
No, I'll give it to Warren. Please let their
So we need nothing more than that, right? We don't need to vote on that.
No.
We can't vote. It's just, I don't know. But, Ward and Vivian will represent us in that direction.
Okay.
Progress. Okay, item 4, Wireless Communications Subcommittee update. Mr. Wright.
Currently, we're predominantly almost done. Hopefully we get through two more meetings, we'll be complete and ready to go. The biggest headache, which was the biggest headache day one going in, is the setbacks. And consciously or not, it has been shown in writing that the objections to the Williams having the 1,500 feet setbacks is augmentation, which is not.
Yeah.
It is prohibited. So we know for a fact that that number 1,500 came from, and we know that they're addressing it from that standpoint. We are, from the last committee, we're going to have three different options that we're going to discuss in our next meeting on the 2nd. One by planning. I'm doing one with the Steve Porter or System Cellular, and then William CAC is going to present one. So we're going to have the three of us bring one back to the table in our meeting, and we're going to try and see if we can whittle it down to something presentable to the commission. You may get two options, but without question, we know where some of it's coming from. Yeah.
Earlier, dig it.
So through. And I don't really care about political correctness as much as just being
Well, the issue of setback is a safety issue, but it's from a falling tower standpoint, right? Not from electromagnetic radiation.
Correct. Correct. Federal law says you can't judge it on radiation. Right. It's illegal. And the biggest radiation study in the world just was released last week and said there's no evidence.
City Council said there was.
Yeah, well, City Council's idiots. So the biggest study that followed 10,000 people over 10 years, there is no evidence that dictates it creates any hazards. More radiation from your microwave or your computer than you do your phone. Granted, if you live with the phone next year, there's a potential you could have more issues, but tell people that they can't hold the phone to their ear.
Could you really elaborate? What is 1,500?
From a study in France and Australia, and then I actually saw it in writing from the presenter from the Williams CAC, and they had a breakdown of it was 255, 250, 655, 1,000 feet, and 1,500 feet. And they're all saying there's health issues from 0 to 1,500 feet. So they don't want anything below 1,500 feet.
Is this a so-called scientific study or
quasi-study? They say the cows are going to blow.
Yeah.
So, and we've had some discussions, and the last one was, I don't want to say it was heated because it really wasn't heated. It was a good discussion, but there were some very blatant questions thrown on the table. Is a kid going to care if there's a cell tower on the store next door from the school? You're at the high school. How many kids have their phones and they're running all day long? And
you know, in my previous career, I was in charge of schools, three of them, that were within a quarter mile of a 50,000-watt AM radio station, which is the largest AM radio station that you can have in this country. Mm-hmm. Since 1948, no ill effects.
There's
nothing. There's no logic in it.
You have GPHS, which is 4 blocks from the county building, from the courthouse. Mm-hmm. There's towers on the courthouse.
Yeah, I know. And those are minimal compared to a 50,000-watt radio station.
The issue that we are trying to address in the committee is justification. You're saying 1,500 feet. What is your justification? If it's not on radiation, what are you justifying that says it needs to be 1,500 feet?
No, I really got to hand it to you, Ron. David, I've been just exhausted by the argument from, you know, you can't get a solid answer out of them. But I got to hand it to you guys. You guys have a lot more patience than I am. I'm just exhausted.
It sounds like it's emotional. It's an emotional argument.
It has a tendency to be. Shivana, who represents the Williams CAC, been wonderful. She gets a little frustrated. Some of the other people get a little frustrated. The positive thing is, I understand that now. So you can see the light bulb click on. One of the big issues is how far you need to be from the tower. Well, cell phone towers do not generate a lot of power. They purposely have less power so they can get the signal what they need to be. So you're going to have some more of them, or you've got your 6 or 10, 20-mile coverage, depending on what tower and what frequency it's at. There's different varying factors. But you have to have a couple more towers to keep the signal low. So there is also the equipment, and that's one of the issues they brought up. Well, we need an engineer to inspect and design this. Well, a system has to be certified. The equipment is certified because FCC regulations going out the door. So you don't need an engineer to come in and say, this certified transmitter is going to transmit what it says it's going to transmit. That kind of stuff.
You don't have to reinvent the wheel.
You don't have to reinvent it. That stuff gets a little wacky. Yeah. So we've had some great progress. Our last two meetings went really well. We've got some good things done. And if we get through the setbacks.
From a staff standpoint, I can confirm that the wireless communications ordinance, one of the concerns I had when I first came on board as planning director, and that was one of the first documents I picked read, was the proposed wireless communications ordinance, and I found that it would be very difficult to implement. And so staff has been approaching this. We've left the
We've had Northwest Wireless Association, we've got wireless providers and builders of systems, we've got the Williams CAC. I think we've got, you know, a nice balance on that committee of what all the different perspectives are. Staff's primary role has been, can we implement this ordinance? Don't give us a standard that I can't write a permit on. And I think we're dangerously close to having that ordinance in place. And as Ron mentioned, there are a few technical details and hard and fast standards to be laid out. The code does have a couple of sections that we're looking at. One is criteria-based, where they are subjective. There is some room for, you know, is the tower too close? Is it visually screened? Is it enough screening? Those are subjective kind of decisions. So we do have that element of the wireless ordinance. It's a small portion of that code, but it is there, and it's mostly on visual impacts and mitigating some of the impacts to residential properties. I don't think any of us would probably want a wireless tower right in front of our view house. From our house.
Camouflage.
Ron
didn't
want one.
Dave, I'm not sorry. You said we're dangerously close to having an ordinance that you cannot
been a long time coming, and a lot of wordsmithing and a lot of looking at how phrases impact that. But I think we're close to having an ordinance we can implement with a few more of the dimensional standards, the hard and fast standards that need to be worked out in this version of the code. But we're anticipating that we'll have an ordinance in front of the Planning Commission, and that's why we have that tentative date of December. We did lose our October meeting, so we lost 1 month there to the subcommittee because we had some sicknesses or people couldn't work.
I felt a lot better when a gentleman testified, an expert testified to our commission, the wattage coming out of the tops of these towers is 20 watts,
right,
as opposed to 50,000
or 100,000.
And then by the time you, having a little engineering background, I know that the power drops off as the square of the distance. But by the time you're 80 or so feet away, it's a million times less than what it is right there at the tower top. And none of us are at the tower top, so we're down where it's a million times less. I forgot about this. My worries went away about the power issue.
Actually, if you're underneath the tower, there's no signal because it's all pushing outwards.
Right.
So the safest place to be is right under the tower.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Is the cell phone generating essentially the same frequency as the tower? And if so, or even if not, how much power comes out of the cell phone, like a milliwatt or something? And, I mean, if you're putting it right next to your ear, it's going to be a lot of power compared to something that's a quarter mile away.
But
is it the same frequency?
It is the same frequency because they're talking to each other, so they have to talk on the same frequency. That's not a question.
One question I have for the Planning Commission is, given the technical nature of the issues with wireless communications, are you comfortable with taking the subcommittee's recommendations and going forward to hearing with those? Do you want to see them in a workshop before we decide to do that? Tell me what the next step is that you're going to be comfortable with, because a public hearing is going to be out there. There will be a lot of technical questions and questions for the Planning Commission.
Right.
And you won't have a RF engineer sitting there by your side to help you make those decisions. So if you can tell me kind of what your comfort level is, we can either workshop it again and discuss more of the technical issues, or you can take the subcommittee's word for it and go on to hearing.
I'll take the subcommittee's word. I'd
like to at least have some written documents to look over before the hearing.
That would be good. I don't know that we need to have a whole workshop, but certainly to have some technical documents that we can read so we know what we're talking about at the hearing.
You asked for it, Margaret.
We've got to read down about a third or a quarter of what it was. Now, one of the other issues is they wanted to do a line-by-line dot T cross, and there's just places that we don't need to be messing with, that staff needs to just, we need to say, hey,
right,
you need to word this. Mm-hmm. So that's what he was talking about, the wordsmithing. And there was whole sections where they wanted to go in
and be extremely restrictive. And again, it's a county ordinance. It's not a Williams ordinance.
No.
So
I think it's
as chair, have directed Dave to, okay, we're gonna put this in the PD's lap and let him come up with the language, and then we just review the language. So that way it's more universal, it's more structurable, and enforceable. So it's not just somebody coming up with crap and he says, well, what the hell is this? You know, actually enforceable, and we can use it in the ordinance.
So the last meeting in October didn't take any
No, a bunch of us couldn't make it, so.
Okay, and all the ones Shavana had a whole and other set thing trying to
do. So I hear a workshop.
I'm okay either way.
Technical.
I would say let's wait till after this next workshop and email out a tentative revision draft for it and let them start looking at it.
There you go.
Okay. And then make a determination.
If the date in December we had originally set for the text amendment hearing itself, if we don't think we're there, we could pull that into that workshop evening and spend half an hour to an hour on wireless.
Yeah, and we really need to, the questions you're asking in the waters, the technical stuff,
deeply.
And we can arrange, would hope Northwest Wireless have a representative when we get to that point where we actually get to the hearing, because that's what they do. They're the wireless association. So get an independent body who doesn't work for a specific company, who's just industry-wide. They pretty much know all the codes up and down the state. They'll have valuable information as to whether this is valid, not valid, what have you.
Okay. I think we're good to go.
Okay.
Item 5, commission discussion. Anybody have anything they want to discuss with commissioners?
I got one question.
All right.
I'm wondering about Don Morey as being our chair. He seems to be missing more than he's here. And I know he's got that house in Florida and stuff, and I think that's probably where he's going to spend his time. And I wondered.
He's on a ship right now.
Is he on a ship? Okay. So he seems to be gone more than
I don't think there's any cell coverage out there either.
So I just wondered if we should entertain the option of replacing him as chair.
Last conversation I had with Don, he's all in, but this is his vacation period, and he kind of had two of them back-to-back. One got rescheduled, apparently a fishing trip. And so
plus, he missed two meetings because of conflict of interest, which is not missing the meetings.
Right. It's just a thought.
Yeah, he's got a month left, a month and a half. Either way.
Oh, on his term?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Well, the chair is elected every year, so.
Oh.
Well, he's 12 months. He'll be in for 12 months.
I'm not sure what he's.
It's been that long.
What is that? No, he just got elected, right?
No, it's at the January. They elect a new one, chair and vice chair.
Is that what you do? You don't go like.
Annually. No. Annually.
Normally January. But that's not the end of his term. It's the end of the chairman.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's why I was referencing the end of the chair. So.
Okay, anything else? Commissioners? Okay, is there any public comments from the public? Anyone from the public have any comments?
Bye, public.
Frederick Nippleman. When you're discussing the cell phone tower issue, I would like to suggest that you somehow bring in one of the critics of cell phone towers to person so that you get in person that viewpoint, the opposite viewpoint. Everyone that's been mentioned to come to the hearing has somehow been involved with the industry on a paid basis.
So that's what the William CAC is. They're the critic. The William CAC is the critic. They're an organized group out of Williams.
Oh, and they're going to come to the workshop?
Oh, okay. They will be invited.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure they'll be at the hearing. I don't know about the workshop, but...
Well, I would suggest the workshop, that they be invited to the workshop.
Yeah.
And then...
Well, I suppose it'll be publicly noticed.
Yeah, the workshop's for us.
Yeah, I thought that was ours.
I'm sure they'll be noticed. Whether they decide to show up or not, it's up to them. But yeah, we'll
but you're inviting other people, so I'm suggesting that you be equal.
Right.
Well, we don't really want to be equal. We just want one-sided.
We want to be equal. Any other comments from the public? Yes.
Harold Haugen. I was going to say anything until he mentioned it. I think when you start inviting people to provide testimony in workshops, you're moving from a workshop to a public hearing. You get real close, and that you're close tonight in receiving information that normally would have been probably better off not inviting people, but sticking in a workshop with discussions out, mm-hmm. rather than creating that perception that this could wind up being a public hearing.
But on the other hand, you're bringing in outsiders, and you can set time limits.
Not bringing
but that would be a hearing, I think.
Yeah, that's a hearing. We're not having hearings in this room.
Should we even have comments from the public on a workshop?
That's a chairman issue, but yeah, that's fine. Most workshops, they don't. The ones I go to the other counties, they do not allow any comments.
All right, we'll take all of those comments to heart. Any other comments at all before we adjourn? I move we adjourn. Let's
second
go home. Thank you all for coming.